It's a joke. Darn.
Sorry, my homework will make your day.
So we were starting to talk about the transformation of electromagnetic fields and some of the phenomena that arise as a result. I think I had just, let me summarize where I left things. We're going to talk about taking this general form of the Lorentz transformation, including the rotation part here with these spin generators, rotation generators, and then the boost generators with a vector zeta in x, y, and z that controls the amount of boost in the three coordinates. And the Mathematica notebook that I posted in the supplement directory, you can just directly evaluate this matrix for any angles of the rotation and the boost that you like. But let's specialize just because it's kind of nice to have a very simple geometry to velocity between the reference frames along the x-axis. And then we're talking about a boost only, and then the mixed contravariant covariant Lorentz transformation matrix, which is dx prime alpha dx beta, can be written in terms of these, the boost along x, hyperbolic sines and cosines, and in more familiar terms, it's just gamma minus beta gamma minus beta gamma gamma and this we use to transform the electromagnetic field matrix from one frame to another, the contravariant components in the primed frame will be lambda F lambda transpose, and again F is 0 minus EX minus EY minus EZ EX EY EZ, our anti-symmetric field tensor, and then 0 minus BZ, BY, 0, minus BX, 0, and then BX, BZ, minus BY. Okay, so you can do those multiplications like with the Mathematica notebook, or let me just give you the result of doing this lambda F lambda transpose. So they give EX prime is equal to EX. Well, that's a disappointment, not very interesting. BX prime is BX. Why am I doing this? Okay, here's something a little more interesting. Orthogonal field component is EY prime is gamma times EY minus beta BZ. And B by prime is gamma times by plus beta ez. And ez prime is gamma times ez plus beta by. And bz prime is gamma times bz plus, sorry, minus beta ey. So those are the general formulas for a boost along the x-axis. And again, this means we have a frame K where we know the fields in the unprimed K frame, and then there is a frame K prime moving in the positive axis, x-axis at velocity v, and their origins coincide usually at time zero. And if we have the fields in one frame, we can get them in the other frame. And if you're given the opposite, we would need the inverse transformation. If you're given the fields in frame K prime and you want them in frame K, you can obtain it from these formulas by making a couple of changes. First, interchange everywhere the primed and unprimed fields. So now we'll have EY is something with EY prime and BZ prime. And secondly, change the sine of beta. And that gives you the reverse transformation. It's kind of interesting that you can write this even for more complex geometries. I'm not going to derive it, but you might convince yourself with a couple of examples that it works. I'll give you the general formula. Again, just for a general boost in an arbitrary direction. So we'll have a velocity v relative to k that defines a vector now, beta, v over c. And the general formula is e prime is gamma times e vector plus cross product beta cross b minus gamma squared over gamma plus 1 beta times the scalar beta dot e. And b prime vector is similarly gamma times b minus beta cross e minus gamma squared over gamma plus 1 beta vector times beta dot b. And if you do much work with relativity or at accelerators, you probably will want to use formulas like this all the time. So let's talk a little about what really happens then in implications of this. some observations. First one, obviously, E and B are getting mixed up when you change from one reference frame to another. And so might seem a little counterintuitive, but what you have called an electric effect in one frame can look like a combination of electric and magnetic effects in another frame, or maybe even predominantly magnetic. That's pretty wacky. And in that sense, the E and B fields are maybe not the most fundamental quantities. That maybe you could argue that the field tensor is the key quantity. It just got a bunch of components, and they control the motion of particles, the forces on particles. And to kind of see an example of that, let's take the kind of simplest example of a moving charge. Okay, so let's take a point charge Q. And let's just move it at constant velocity through space. We won't say how we're doing that, like with what fields or so on. But this moving charge will itself create fields. Okay, so we just set a charge moving in outer space. There are no fields around to change its velocity. It continues, but it generates fields. Okay, so this constant velocity is relative to some observer's frame. Which I'll call the K frame, where the observer is at rest. Okay, so we're sitting here, we see the charge fly by. And to look at this, they'll pick two frames to look at this physics. Let's call K prime the rest frame of the charge. Since it's at a constant velocity, this is an inertial reference frame. And we'll say that the origins of K and K prime coincide at time zero. Which will be the zero of time in each frame. And let's further place the observer at a particular point, not exactly on the axis of the relative velocity, but let's put him off axis somewhere, like at a point P, which is on the observer frame x-axis, at x equals 0, but up on the y-axis, a distance b away from the x-axis, and at z equals 0, too. That's in frame K, where the observer is sitting. Okay. So let's make a diagram of the situation. Let's just show the spatial coordinates here in this graph. So this will be the y-axis here. This will be the x-axis here. This is frame K, and the origin here. And here's the observer at point P, 0, B, 0. And at some t greater than 0, the charge, which I'll keep at the origin of frame K prime, is the x prime, y prime axes. Right. Then the vector from the charge at this time, some later time t prime, greater than 0, there'll be a vector to the observer, which in frame p prime, or sorry, I should say the position p prime in, relative to an observer moving along with the charge in K prime, right, would be P prime would be minus VT prime B zero, right, because the side direction to the velocity is not affected by the Lorentz transformation. Okay. And both observers agree on the relative velocity. Right, they both agree on the relative velocity between their frames. So this distance r prime, we could write as square root of b squared plus v squared t prime squared, as seen by the observers in k prime. And again, k prime is moving to the right at velocity v. And so let's relate these quantities. T prime is gamma times t minus vx over c squared. And this is then simply gamma t here, since x equals 0 at the point P, at the observation point. And naturally, in frame K prime, the charge is not moving. So it's a charge at rest. So there is only an E field, an electric field. At the observation point P prime, and we could calculate it. Ex component prime would be Q over R prime squared times the component in the x prime direction, which is obtained by taking vt minus vt prime over r prime, right? So it makes sense. The x component will be negative to the left at p prime in the prime frame, in k prime, which is minus q vt prime over r prime cubed. Or more explicitly, then it's minus qv gamma t over b squared plus gamma squared v squared t squared relative to the coordinates to the observer in frame k. And similarly, you can get the y component in the primed frame. Of the electric field. We need more chalk. This will be QB over R prime cubed. Do the trig, which in terms of the variables in frame K are QB over B squared plus gamma squared V squared T squared to the 3/2, and EZ prime will be 0, and B prime will be 0. So to put these now in frame K, we'll need the inverse of the transformation I wrote earlier using the rules we made for doing the inverse, which I'll go ahead and write. So EX will be equal to EX prime. BX will still equal BX prime. EY will be gamma times EY prime plus beta BZ prime. BY be gamma BY prime minus beta EZ prime. EZ will be gamma EZ prime minus beta BY prime. And finally, BZ will be gamma BZ prime plus beta EY prime. Okay. So let's apply these formulas to our current example. And we'll have EX equals EX prime, which is minus Q gamma VT over B squared plus gamma squared V squared T squared to 3/2. This is what observer at P in frame K will see for the electric field along X. In terms of the variables, the time variable in the frame X, EY will just be gamma EY prime, since there is no primed B field. And that is gamma QB over b squared plus gamma squared v squared t squared to the 3/2. And bz only, again, only involves the electric field in the prime frame, because there is no magnetic prime frame, is gamma beta ey prime, which is gamma beta qb over b squared plus gamma squared v squared t squared to the 3/2. And these other components are all zero. Ez, bx, and by. Okay, so that's the math. Let's talk about what it means. So, point one, to an observer in K, at this point P, you can calculate the ratio of the X and Y components. That'll tell you the angle the electric field is pointing to the observer in K. And that is, those denominators drop out, and you just get minus VT over B. Now that's an interesting point, because in words, that is saying that the field E, as seen by the observer P in K, it points directly away from the charge, but what is maybe counterintuitive, it points away from its present position at the exact same time, and not away from the position at the retarded time. I don't have a deeper interpretation of that fact. Just comes out of the math. I didn't put my charge here. I should do that. Second point is that now there is a non-zero magnetic field, and this is expected because to an observer in frame K, we have a moving charge, which represents a current. To the observer in K. And one could calculate that by the Biot-Savart law. Came to know and love last semester, which is equation 5.5 in the text, but converted to Gaussian units. And you should be able to verify this for yourself. This says that B would equal Q over C V cross R over R cubed. And so for our example here, where V is V x hat and R vector is minus VT x hat plus B y hat, this means the Biot-Savart law in frame K would be beta times Q B over R cubed, unit vector in the z hat direction. At this observation point, right, which you expect, right? Again, right-hand rule, it should be the z-axis is out of the board, it should be positive. If Q is positive at this point, it should be coming out of the board. This formula is equivalent to what we derived here, except there was this factor of gamma. So this result from this elementary argument using the Biot-Savart law is only valid, this derivation, at low velocities. At higher velocities, you've got to include this gamma. So beta has to be much less than 1 and gamma approximately 1 for the Biot-Savart law formula to be valid. Next, I want to look at the time pattern of the fields seen in frame K, which I've just erased. So this is point observation 3 about this just simple example. So at time t equals 0, right, that's the point of closest approach to the charge to the observer. And you expect the fields to be maximum at that time, right? So you'll get a maximum electric field at that time equal to gamma Q over B squared, which goes to infinity if you crank up the speed of the velocity faster and faster, closer and closer to the speed of light. All right, gamma diverges in that limit. So basically, this means the observer K at this location 0b0 will see a pulse, an electric field pulse of the y component of electric field and a pulse of magnetic field as well because bz here is beta ey, which will be approximately equal to Ey if you go in the ultra-relativistic limit where beta is getting closer and closer to 1. Okay. So what we have, if we look on a time axis, one of these quantities like EY, is, we'll see from that denominator that I've deleted now that had V squared, T squared, and this B squared all to the 3/2 power, you'll see a pulse that looks something like that. And what we've just derived the peak value of this is at gamma Q over B squared. So you get this enhancement by gamma, which could be quite large. And there will be some time duration of this pulse that is of interest, which is approximately B over gamma V, is about how long this pulse of field is felt in frame K. And again, this goes to zero, of course, as beta gets closer and closer to one in the ultra-relativistic limit. So you might wonder, well, how big might gamma be? So imagine we have gone to CERN, and we have circulating protons. They're moving pretty fast at CERN. Gamma, I think in the current machine, is getting close to 6,000 for those protons. These are really fast particles. And so this relativistic effect on the fields is not a tiny thing. It's a huge change in the rest frame. As we sit there, an observer watching a charge go by, whew, that was really impressive. Okay, I think I wanted also to get the integrated pulse strength under this curve, which might be of interest, not just how big it got at the peak, but how much integrated strength there was that the observer sees. Which will be found by doing the integral of Ey dx along the charge particle's path, which is also the integral of Ey times V dt, and that's this integral of gamma Q V B dt over this denominator, B squared plus gamma squared V squared T squared to the 3/2. And this works out to be a simple integral 2Q over B. And one interesting thing is that this answer is independent of the velocity, the integrated pulse strength. Then I guess there was another way Jackson talks about this, which I maybe go over, that you might find alternative representation useful. So Jackson introduces this unit vector n hat pointing at the charge and defines this angle psi relative to the velocity vector that that direction n hat makes. And then does some trig, writes B as R sine of pi minus psi, which is R sine of psi. And VT writes as R cosine of pi minus psi, which is minus R cosine psi. And then writes the fields in terms of this angle psi seen in reference frame K at the observer, EX is QR cosine psi over gamma squared R cubed 1 minus beta squared sine squared psi to the 3 halves. And EY is QR sine psi over gamma squared R cubed 1 minus beta squared sine squared psi to the 3 halves. And I went through the algebra, why our old formulas end up taking this form, but I think I'll spare you that algebra. And so, in fact, you can find a simple and rather compact formula for the electric field in K. At the observer location is E is QR over gamma squared R cubed 1 minus beta squared sine squared psi to the 3 halves. And from this you can see a few simple observations. Again, E goes in the low velocity limit to Q R hat over R squared, as we expect from Coulomb's law. And secondly, E is proportional to this R hat or n hat vector, which is directed radially outward from the charge's present position, as I stressed earlier. And thirdly, maybe most interesting about this derivation, is that the electric field is not isotropic in frame K the way it is in K prime. So in particular, at any R value, the magnitude of E is max at the point where sine squared psi is equal to 1, which means at psi is plus or minus pi over 2. And minimum at sine squared psi equals 0, which is, of course, psi is 0 or pi. So I can sketch that pictorially, which I think is a good picture to keep in mind, this diagram I'm about to draw, to keep track of the qualitative nature of this transformation. That when beta is much less than 1 for a moving charge, you're in the extreme non-relativistic limit. You've got Q here. Field lines are going out spherically symmetric. Right, isotropic. But as beta gets closer to 1, it's highly anisotropic. And if we have our charge Q moving in this direction, the field lines are much more bunched in this 90-degree line as the charge comes by at high velocity. The field lines are kind of squeezed up, and it's sort of an analogy of length contraction, in a sense, that the field lines are sort of contracted in the sideways direction. Pretty wacky, that relativity. That's all I want to do in chapter 11. But chapter 12 holds more mysteries and fun that we will now go into. Real relativistic dynamics. Are any of you working with extreme relativistic situations, accelerators or shocks in outer space? Well, maybe you are.
I don't have
friends. Okay. Well, that's almost as good, as long as you've got friends. Okay, so let me remind you the equations of motion of a charge moving through fixed fields. Let's pick an elementary charge like a proton. So we'll give it charge E moving through E and B fields. Well, we have a Lorentz force on the particle, which we've written before as dp dt of the spatial part of the momentum is, of course, E times the electric field plus U over C cross B. If we are in a frame where the particle instantaneous velocity is u. We also have the rate of change of the total energy of the particle is equal to the charge magnitude times u dotted into the E field. Power is force dotted into velocity, basically. And the B field term is orthogonal, so it does not contribute to the change of energy. And we, in class, I think last lecture, found their manifestly covariant form of these equations. Which was d by d tau, rate of change with respect to the proper time of the particle, of the four velocity, is E over mass times the speed of light, the contraction of our electromagnetic antisymmetric field tensor, F alpha beta, with the covariant components U beta. So this is really all you need to know to talk about the motion of particles in fixed fields, ignoring the fact that, like, if you have some accelerations, they're going to create their own fields. Accelerated charges radiate, are going to add to the fields out there. Some of those fields can act back on it. That's all the subject of chapter 16, this back action of the fields created by the charge acting back on it. That's a really tricky subject. But while these are classically complete equations, ignoring the quantum world for now, we do know there's a quantum world lurking. And the quantum world does not work with forces. It works with a Hamiltonian or a Lagrangian. And so we want, our goal here is to recast these equations into Lagrangian and Hamiltonian form. Then we'll have something we can quantize. QM is lurking. Having said that, it's kind of an amazing thing to me about the motion of charges in fields, even applying to atoms and such, is most of those phenomena actually can be described by treating the electromagnetic fields classically. A few exceptions, like spontaneous emission of radiation, although even that might be questioned by some people who have found tricky ways to even treat that in some sense classically, to some degree. But still, there are quantum phenomena, and those are increasingly the phenomena people care about nowadays as really current modern research topics, are the subset of all electromagnetic phenomena that are dominated by the quantum aspects. So how are we going to do this? Let's start with a fundamental principle, the principle of least action. And remind you how that goes in just ordinary Newtonian mechanics. It's usually phrased in the following way. Let's suppose particle is going to move from one phase space point, A, I'll call it, which has a position, initial position, and an initial velocity at time TA. And it's going to move to a new position in phase space which is has components QI. Oh, I wanted to call these QIA and QI dot A. It moves to QIB and QI dot time derivative B at time TB. So it's going to do that. It's going to get from here, from A to B, with specified position and velocity at each point, and time. So according to the principle of least action, the trajectory it will follow is the one that minimizes the action. And the action is defined as the integral from time TA to time TB of the Lagrangian that depends on QI of T and QI dot of T, depends on the positions and velocities, integral dt. So it's a rather remarkable rephrasing of Newton's laws of motion that it can be recast this way. In Newton's laws, you start with your initial position and velocity, and then you do F equals ma, and you move step by step, and you follow your nose every step of the way. In the principle of least action, you have a global idea that, okay, we're going to consider the whole global trajectory. There are an infinite number of possible trajectories, and in the end, there is one that gives a minimum value of this action that is the one followed. Interesting mathematics that those two pictures give the same answer. And the transition to Lagrangian or Hamiltonian frameworks hinge, of course, on that equality. So basically, from this, you derive, once you've specified the problem in this language as a minimization problem, then you can derive the equations of motion and ultimately the trajectory by demanding that this integral be stationary with respect to small changes in that trajectory. and in fact, not just stationary, but a minimum. Although sometimes there are exceptions to that minimum, but it's always stationary. And so that is achieved by setting to zero the first variation of this variational expression. We'll take delta A in variational differentiation notation. The first variation, which has to be zero, will be the sum over the different components of the coordinate system. Integral TA to TB of the first variation you bring inside the integral, and you'll have a partial L with respect to the QI times the first variations of the delta QIs. And then you'll have the partial of the Lagrangian with respect to the derivatives, which are treated as independent variables in Lagrangian dynamics, times the first variation of those, of the ith derivative. Again, this delta QI dot means delta of dQI dt, which is d by dt of delta QI, just notationally. And in this form, you can't really conclude very much yet, because you have two independent types of variations going on in this integral. And so we do the first rule of theoretical physics. We integrate this term by parts. And now this term, after doing that, will also be proportional to delta QI. That's how we always do these, what are called the derivation of the Euler-Lagrange equations, which is turning this variational stationary principle into the differential equations of motion. So that's what I'm just going through the steps, how you do this in ordinary classical mechanics at this point. So that leads to this equation. Delta A is zero, which is also now the sum over the different coordinates. Integral TA to TB, partial Lagrangian with respect to QI, minus total derivative of partial Lagrangian with respect to QI dot. The entire quantity now multiplied by delta QI. We've gotten rid of the delta QI dot and integrated dt. And then there are surface terms in general, partial L, partial QI dot from the integration by parts, delta QI evaluated from TA to TB. And now this term, the surface term, under certain conditions of the variational principle, the way it's applied, will be zero. In particular, it's zero if you only restrict yourself and find only those trajectories that started at A with the specified position and derivative, and ended at B at this specified time, TB, and position and velocity at that point. Then if we restrict ourselves only to those trajectories, then delta Q is zero. And we can ignore this surface term. And then, in order for this integral to vanish for arbitrary small delta q's, near the trajectory of interest, the quantity in parentheses has to itself be zero, which are giving us the Euler-Lagrange equations, which are now differential equations, whose solution are the trajectory. Now, you've all seen this kind of Lagrangian mechanics or kinematics, if you like, as undergraduates, if not anywhere else. But let me just go through a simple example to kind of get you back thinking about variational method and do a non-relativistic example as a reminder. How would we apply this to a projectile near the Earth's surface? You could do it on the moon if you want. That might be more appropriate right now. What's G? 1/6 the Earth? Is that the G on the moon? Is it 1/6 of the Earth? 1/7? But you're an astronomer. It's too close. Okay. So let's just look at two-dimensional coordinate system, x and y, or as we like to do in relativity, let's call them x1 and x2. X1 is a horizontal and x2 is vertical. And we're going to have a particle fired from 0, 0. And we want this projectile moving under gravity to end up at some point L comma 0 at time t, some specified time interval capital T. So that's x2, x1. And take our non-relativistic Lagrangian T minus V, which is the kinetic energy M over 2 x1 dot squared plus x2 dot squared minus mg x2 for the local gravity effect. And for these specified initial and final points, can write our action integral. Integral 0 to time t of 1 half m x1 dot squared plus x2 dot squared minus mg x2 of t dt. And we're trying to find x1 of t and x2 of t. So take the first variation, set it to 0, you sum from 1 to 2 over the components, and then the integral 0 to capital T. You can jump to the Euler-Lagrange equations and skip the integration by parts step. That's d by dt partial L partial xi dot delta xi dt plus the surface terms. We're going to say are 0. And now these, equating this for both I equals 1 and 2, the curly brace to 0, we have that partial L partial x1, which is 0, of course. There's no force in the x1 direction, no x1 dependence, minus d by dt partial L partial x1 dot is 0, and so that's the equation d by dt of m x1 dot is 0, or x1 dot is constant, and the value has to be L over t times little t to solve the difference equation with those initial conditions and final conditions. And secondly, partial L partial x2 minus d by dt partial L partial x2 dot is 0, which gives the equation minus mg minus d by dt mx2 dot is 0. And that is just x2 double dot is minus g, not q, g, which has the solution x2 of t is v2t, an integration constant times time, minus 1 half gt squared. And you can find v2 by demanding that x2 of time t, we want to be 0. We want to have gone up and come back down to the same point. So v2 is 1 half g capital T. And we have the final solution from Lagrangian approach. X1 of t then is L over capital T times time, and x2 of t is 1 half g times t capital T minus little t squared. Just an example how you would tackle these without following your nose in Newton's laws, one tiny step to another, always adjusting based on the forces in the at that instant along the way. You get the same answer. Next time, we'll do relativistic Lagrangian dynamics and maybe Hamiltonian too. Thus ist alles. If you came in late, there is a new homework assignment.